Cackle on. Hopefully nobody out there gets too frightened by it. In fact, what was it? My sister was telling me the other day, parrots, all right? Parrots are an opportunity that are just waiting to be exploited. For example, she knows a parrot that they've decided to call Evil Parrot. The reason why they call the parrot Evil Parrot is because every time they say the words Evil Parrot goes, eh, 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 eh. So what are you doing, Evil Parrot? And the second opportunity that you can exploit with your parrot at home is teach it to say, help, they've turned me into a parrot. Freak out your neighbours. Right, back to the show. You're listening to the Finny Eastwood Show with Will. And supposedly we're going to have a couple of guests on today. Jonathan Elinoff, who made a series called The Core of Corruption, who also, interestingly enough, wrote a wonderful article called 33 Conspiracies That Turned Out to Be True, which received over 2 million views worldwide and counting. And that's hour number one. Hour number two, we'll have Tim Selwyn from Tumukia to talk about the New Zealand issues of the week. Most notably, or at least likely, the distraction issue about Paul Henry. As if you're unfamiliar with Paul Henry, he's a bit of a knob at the best of times. But this week he's done something, well, I would say foolish, but on the other hand, I'd simply say it's insignificant. We have a Governor-General who was, born here, educated here, and yet of Indian descent, and he says to the Prime Minister, hey, perhaps our next Governor-General could be more like a Kiwi. And you'd be surprised over that one statement, the whole country is up in arms! Oh, let's get his head right here! But John Key says, hey, we're not going to put up GST at all. And then he puts up GST, and the whole country goes, meh.
They're all surface idiots, aren't they, Vinny?
God! The
They're nuts, man. They're nuts. I think we should do a podcast on mental illness.
Yep. And we'll provide an example of mental illness on this show each and every day with Will.
I mean, we already do. The show is already about mental illness, but a dedicated podcast to the mental illness scum and the media.
Yep, people don't have enough dedication to mental illness these days. You're listening to the Finny Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back after the break.
The way it's going to be.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh, yeah. Sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh, yeah. It's business time. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
That's what you mean. You mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business. It's business time.
Oh, yeah. That's right. We go brush our teeth. That's all part of it. That's foreplay. You go sort out the recycling. That's not part of it, but it's still very important. Next thing you know, we're in the bedroom. You're wearing that ugly, baggy t-shirt from that team-building exercise you did for your old work. And it's never looked better on you. I take off my trousers and trip over them, but I turn it into a little dance that makes you think, yum, he's very sexy. Now I'm down to just my socks. And you know, when I'm down to just my socks, what time it is. It's time for business. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
You know, when I'm wearing my socks, it's business time. They're business socks.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio and, incidentally, the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. And as we were talking about before the break, we have a very special guest for y'all, to use the parlance of our Texan comrades. It's Jonathan Alanoff, who made a little film called Core of Corruption and, incidentally, made a little article called The 33 Conspiracies That Turned Out to Be True, which has 2 million plus hits to date. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. This is awesome.
Oh, mate. Well, lovely to have you on. And in addition to making Core of Corruption and making this little article, you're quite the old internet activist, I hear. I was wondering if you might actually fill in the details about how you woke up as a truther.
I was always a Kennedy researcher. Kennedy assassination was kind of like my forte when I was a kid. And after 9/11... I read a David Icke book, believe it or not, called The Biggest Secret, which got me really into a whole bunch of other stuff. And, of course, The Biggest Secret was not about 9/11. It was about other things. But, you know, it took about, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years, and I came across Mike Rupert and Alex Jones and, of course, all the other figures that many people know now, and then it just kind of went downhill from there for me. Reading all the books, and I decided I wanted to do a film about September 11th. So, and that's how I did it.
You're breaking up a little there, man. It's kind of difficult to hear you, but we'll see if we can deal with it and perhaps get you reconnected on a landline there as well. But it sounds like you've got a similar wake-up story to a lot of people, and it's truthers who are already awake that guide the rest of us into doing a lot more in the movement and waking up to an even greater extent, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I would say so. Are you guys picking me up okay, or do you want to call me on a landline?
We'll probably call you on the landline. Yeah.
All right, why don't you call me at... I'll send you the number here.
Okay, cool. We'll reconnect you in a moment. All right, we'll do that in a second. Thanks, John. All right. So, we were talking... Just, we'll see if we can get him up again. But in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, while we're getting him back up, I kind of wanted to talk about this topic here is about truthers helping to wake each other up. And it's kind of like, well, for example, Vinnie Eastwood and Will doing the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, I'm not sure if we're actually waking anybody up here. All right? Perhaps it's just a whole bunch of people who are already awake that just need to be, well, I don't know, listening to people of like mind and be capable of having a laugh about it, because the difficulty with this movement is just so deadly serious. All right, now I believe we have John back. John, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Oh, mate, that sounds absolutely fabulous. Okay.
All right, beautiful.
Much better, John, much better.
All right, okay. Speaking of puppetry of the parrot. Now, I wanted to talk about your film, Core of Corruption. I saw it a while back, and what I found very interesting was a lot of the old censored ancient history and, well, we had a guest on, Arthur Christian, yesterday, and there's so many topics in this movement that are really, really confusing and esoteric, and Core of Corruption really helped me to understand a lot of these little agendas. And I was wondering if you have any personal wisdom about humanity for us, mate.
Well, speaking in terms of 9/11, I got to be honest with you. I'm still discovering things every day. So, you know, there's one thing that I kind of feel like this movement doesn't always seem to realize all the time, which is that we don't know who committed the attacks of September 11th. It's why we're in this position. We cannot prove Bin Laden did it, because the evidence doesn't point to him, but the evidence doesn't necessarily point to any specific group either. We speculate, you know, could it be, you know, some Mossad? Could it be, I've seen really good evidence that it might be, I've seen good evidence it might be Black Ops, mercenaries, Kroll, could be Ace Elevator. It could be compartmentalized with other mercenary groups outsourced perhaps from France or Germany out of Hamburg. We have evidence that it could be connected to the ISI or the Saudi GID. So people act like, you know, this is a clear-cut case, that it's an obvious, you know, one suspect. It's not. It's not that obvious. The insider trading showed us that. There's something like 30 suspects of insider trading, and they're around the world. So obviously a lot of people had knowledge, a lot of people, and that has to be taken for what it's worth. So,
out of these 30-odd suspects, how many of them got investigated?
Well, in the United States, one of the firms that was investigated was run by Buzzy Krongard, ex-director of the CIA, and it was kind of just thrown out the window. It wasn't taken real serious. As we know, Buzzy Krongard's brother is the used to be the head of Blackwater and, you know, things like that. So, you know, he also, Buzzy Krongard is the ex-director of the CIA. So he was a figure that a lot of people felt should have been questioned and asked, how did his company do so many trades on the stock market that profited from the attacks? And of course, those answers were never given. Originally, there was insider trading investigations, but they were shut down rather quickly. So we never got a full disclosure on that. And if you read the 9/11 Commission report, that's not addressed. In fact, a lot of that stuff is redacted. So somebody's protecting the information about the insider trades. But the news reports around the world confirm that trades on the market show figures profiting from the attacks. So we can look at the news, but even the news is not confirming the names or identifying the people.
And we're not talking about any small chump change worth of...
Oh, no, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah, no, we're talking hundreds of millions here. We're talking substantial monetary gain. Enough to throw an investigation. I mean, in the case of American Airlines and United Airlines and Marsh McLennan, those stocks were well over 1,200% higher than they should have been in put options. Normally, something around 300 to 400% higher is suspicious. On a time when American Airlines and United Airlines stock was rising, for people to place put options is already rare as it is. But in the amounts that they were putting them in, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it made absolutely no sense. Everybody agrees that it's standard protocol to investigate insider trading, that this was beyond enough evidence to show insider trading. And for whatever reason, the United States government didn't investigate it. You know, somebody's protecting somebody. Let's just put it that way.
Well, nobody was out there to protect Martha Stewart.
Right. Well, you know, it's who you know, right? It's who you know, and Wall Street's very much like that, as we all know. It's the same thing with Washington. I mean, people get thrown, they get the book thrown at them in the Supreme Court all the time for cases here in the U.S., but then as we saw with Sybil Edmonds, or as we see all the time with state secrets, cases will get thrown out all the time because, you know, let's face it, it's the reality of it. They can use national security now.
Yeah, now, isn't that interesting, though, that in order for national security to keep chugging along, any form of justice or reality has to be completely ignored?
Well, that's the catch, right?
You know, and the madness is so obvious, and that's the thing that really cracks me up, is that, you know, these reports of insider trading will go out, and everybody will hear about them, and then when the reports and the and everything's blocked, people quickly forget, right? As if $100 million is something that, you know, you just misplace. Much like the, what was it, $2 trillion the day before 9/11 went missing out of the Pentagon's coffers.
Yeah, 2.3. Unbelievable.
Right, right. And the plane, Flight 77, hit the part of the Pentagon that not only was under construction to withstand the impact of a projectile, that was also the only area of the Pentagon that that information, the accounting information, was kept. So it's very interesting you mentioned that.
Yeah, and
was
also
in the model that they produced. Remember, before rebuilding America's defenses in September of 2000, they produced a model of the Pentagon at a particular meeting and had a broken-up craft around it through the center of it. They had it striking that side also, I believe.
That's right, yeah. I mean, the man who participated in that exercise, the pilot at the Pentagon who participated in that exercise, then left the Pentagon only later to get a job working at American Airlines, where he piloted the plane that allegedly flew into the Pentagon. That was in Loose Change, second edition. Dylan Avery's information is absolutely correct.
And so then we then mention that, and people say you've got no respect for the dead, or my pilot's dead, or something, you know what I mean? Like, my husband's dead. Sure, he was a pilot of that aircraft. But then I think the central premise here is, you know, our audience here is well aware 9/11 was an inside job, but the central premise to me is that there's all these coincidences occurring simultaneously within such a short period of time, and the odds of that being so, and all these coincidences favoring the government, is just so astronomically high.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you took statistics, then you know. Yeah, I mean, statistically, we're talking about an improbability beyond. I mean, it's we're talking astronomical numbers here. Statistically, for this many coincidences to take place, it's highly unlikely. I mean, a regular detective, a local cop, can read this and realize that this is not coincidental. I mean, that's like going.
No, they can't. Not now that they've got IQ upper limits.
Right. Well, it's just one of those things. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, the interesting thing is with this is that, you know, it's not just that the conspiracy is so readily available. Research is out there. It's that people draw conclusions that sometimes don't make sense. Not everyone has detective skills or criminal investigation skills. A lot of people jump to conclusions. A lot of people. And you have to remember, the CIA, their game is like Iceberg Slim, as Dave Chappelle says in his stand-up. I don't know if you've seen his stand-up. He's back touring underground now. But he's absolutely right. The way the American government does their dirty work is they frame you, blackmail you, or bribe you. So just because something leads to somebody doesn't necessarily mean that person did it, and it doesn't necessarily mean that's the whole story. So people have to remember, these people are very smart. They know what they're doing. They've been doing this a very long time. They've killed a lot of people. They've overthrown a lot of countries, and America's not the first time that they've had to deal with this. So using the proper detective skills, if you really pay attention to 9/11, it's not so much a country that's behind the attacks, so much as it's figures in a separate agreement. So, you know, what you have is like the five families in New York, the mafia families. Let's imagine that a mafia hit leads to three of those families. Well, which family did it? Well, who's to say it was a family that did it? Let's say members of each family were involved in a separate conspiracy, an agreement between each other. And that's what you have with 9/11. You have figures compartmentalized within the government. And that's how people have to understand this stuff goes on. So when we say, oh, the U.S. government did it, well, wait a second. What about the guys working in cubicles in the Pentagon in suits and ties that go to work every day, and they probably really believe in their job? I bet you anything those guys didn't do it. In fact, I would place money on the fact that 9/11 wasn't planned in Washington. I bet you it was planned in the halls of private homes in New York, France, England, maybe Israel, maybe in Saudi Arabia, maybe in Prague. You know what I'm saying? I highly doubt you're going to find a paper trail.
That's why I focus on secret societies more so than just blaming whole governments carte blanche. Like, you know, there are infiltrations within these organizations, and a lot of the people who attend the Pentagon on a daily basis would think they're defending America and they're patriots. You know what I mean?
Right.
They really do believe in that stuff. They're just short-sighted people, as most people are.
right.
That's the way I see it, yeah. But I think a lot of these groups, like the Bilderbergs and Trilaterals and then secret societies proper, are just breeding grounds for this sort of corruption you're talking about.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing with the Trilateral Commission and things like the Council on Foreign Relations, what people have to understand about these groups specifically, those groups pretty much do business. It's business as usual. And there's kind of a rule of thumb in the aristocracy. I went to a really nice school, and I'm friends with a lot of people who are like that. In fact, I'm friends with a lot of people who are involved with the Council on Foreign Relations. And a lot of people don't understand the way these people work from childhood is it's a good old boys network. So you never say anything outright in public. You're not gonna, if you're hanging out in some boys club and we cheated on a test, you know, in class or something, and you and I are at school, you and I would never discuss such a thing in school. And it's just understood, and you get punished for doing that. So these kids learn very, very early on in their life, don't discuss anything in front of anybody, under any circumstance. So at the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral, you have a lot of figures there who may or may not be involved with anything. So I highly doubt, again...
They're a whole bunch of real dodgy scum, aren't they? Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break with our special guest. The light, ladies and gentlemen. It's a bit of a dubstep harmony thingy going on. Our special guest is Jonathan Alanoff, one of the creators of Core of Corruption. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have, honest and decent truthers on the show.
Awesome,
and you know, the irony is, right, honest and decent truthers are actually kind of difficult to find, just like honest and decent slaves.
Right. And, I was going to say this, but there's such a variety of theories out there about 9/11 that most people tend to stick and gravitate towards the more extreme fringe highly speculative theories, and it's one of the reasons why this stuff isn't taken serious. This stuff is usually not taken serious because most people out there, when they hear about the 9/11 conspiracy or some of the other stuff out there, if they look it up online, if they go to YouTube, or usually when they meet people on the street, the ones that are doing this, sometimes even more actively than others, tend to be not the best representatives. So it's one of the reasons why I got involved in all this is because, you know, we need more people to speak up who are a little bit more centrist, a little bit more about being, you know, credible and objective. So
when you say centrist, how do you mean? Like, what do you think are the more extreme theories that are prevalent? Obviously, the space beam one, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how extreme you want to go. But I mean, I've heard all kinds of extreme theories. Aliens did it. I've heard space beams. I heard all that stuff. I mean, like I said,
crazy guys like Nico Hupton, the Web Fairy, and those crazy people. We don't really want to even give credit to at all.
Right.
Like the theory that it was a controlled demolition seems crazy to a lot of people, but that's what we agree on, right?
Right. Well, the controlled demolition theory I used to think it was actually very crazy until I started actually looking at the potential evidence. And we still actually don't know if it was controlled demolition. It could be some other kind of, I mean, in the traditional sense, I mean, a lot of people think controlled demolition, you know, wiring up a building with thousands of miles of cables and pre-cut, you know, shape cutter charges and drilling and stuff. Who's to say that even that occurred? I mean, there could be some kind of device that is patented that the CIA owns, as they own many, that are not publicly on the market, that are not available, that don't require any type of serious construction, that can be attached rather quickly, maybe within a few, you know, seconds. There could be technology that's wireless.
Building 7 looked like a controlled demolition. The Twin Towers, to me, do not look like a classic controlled demolition.
Right.
And so I totally agree with you there. I think we do need a new investigation. Well, I don't know how you pitch that to people. I don't know if you go from an extreme angle to try and get the fluoride head's interest, or if you go from a real conservative angle that's square and straight and logistical, like Richard Gage, who I think is great and doing a lot of great things for the course, but can lose certain people, you know? So like Alex Jones would get listeners that Richard Gage wouldn't, if you know what I mean?
Right, everyone's getting their own following, right?
Mm.
So, everyone's kind of waking up different demographics of people. One of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to introduce to people that, look, you know, there's no evidence that proves beyond any reasonable doubt who did 9/11. That's why when people say, well, you know, why do you talk about Saudi Arabia in your film or Pakistan? I say, well, if you really want to appease and I shouldn't say appease, but if you really want to be objective about anything, you have to examine and explore anything, even the stuff that you're given. And that includes trails to Saudi Arabia or Pakistan. Anyone who's read all the books on 9/11 and studied the hijackers knows, you know, there's information about these guys that doesn't make any sense. They don't look like Muslim extremists. In fact, what they look like are operatives. The question is who they're working for. And so when people say, well, do you think there were even hijackers? I go, well, let's look at the men that they told us hijacked the planes. If you follow the trail, and that's what I tried to do in the first film and I'm going to continue to do in the other film, if you follow these men, especially people like Muhammad Atta, you get the MO, you get the rap sheet of what looks like an operative working for an intelligence agency or a black market network. So you have a problem there, because Muhammad Atta, who spoke fluent Hebrew, for example, traveled from Egypt to Hamburg on the Congress Bundestag program, which is a program that recruits for the Central Intelligence Agency. The scholarship systems itself are set up by Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger. I mean, it's a very, very elite program. And Muhammad Atta, believe it or not, he was a high school equivalent dropout, got a GED equivalent at a community college in Egypt. I mean, it was, you know, how did this guy suddenly get this advanced scholarship to go to this school in Germany where he's meeting up with these, in this program that trains operatives for black ops? So you have to look at that. What does this mean?
Did he have any isolation factors in his life, for instance, were his parents dead for some reason, or...
Well, that's where we get into this. I mean, here's what's interesting. Muhammad Atta stayed with a couple in Germany, but the paper that reported the original information refused to release the names of the couple he stayed with. And it gets really interesting. Daniel Hopsicker gets on this research, and if you follow that trail, there's probably a really good reason why they refused to tell people who he was staying with in Germany, because this program he was in it. But if you connect Atta to some of the other websites and what they say about him, you know, like I said, he spoke fluent Hebrew, and he starts to look like somebody else. And for example, I'll give you an example. When he traveled to Florida, Atta was heavily involved in the drug trade. Okay, now anyone who's studied black ops, especially intelligence history, knows that the drug trade, for a very long time, is saturated with intelligence assets and agents. It is because in a world of national security, the biggest threat to any system is the black market. So intelligence operatives go into the black market. That's why we have agents running guns and drugs. It's a secret. It's a spy game. But that's how we gather our intelligence, and we don't really tell the American public that because it'll scare them. You know, we glorify James Bond, we glorify these films about 007, but it's not funny. You know, these guys don't pretend to be our enemies. They're literally playing cards with the biggest people, the most powerful black market people in the world. There's probably agents, you know, 2 degrees away from everyone from Ahmadinejad to the biggest cocaine smugglers in Colombia. And it's because
the James Bond series was actually written by Ian Fleming.
Right.
It was a member of MI5.
That's right.
And a few others.
Right, exactly. And the same thing with, what's his name? I'm drawing a blank. But, and Ian Fleming is heavily connected to some interesting people. But, yeah, I mean, we glorify that.
Wasn't he also involved in Operation Paperclip, where they got all the Nazis out of Germany in order to, you know, milk all their skills?
Yeah, a lot of that's connected, yeah.
Mm.
The CIA, the MI5, you know, MI6 actually, they don't stand around with binoculars and do surveillance and stakeouts. They don't guess what's going on inside of a cabin. You know what I mean? They don't guess what's going on inside of a drug cartel. They have guys on the inside. Spies are, especially assets, are everywhere. So if you want to gather intel about anything anti-government, the best place you're going to put your agents is in the black market. So drug running and gun running historically is saturated with intelligence operatives. So when you look back at Muhammad Atta, this guy's in Florida hanging out with these German intelligence assets. And, you know, he's wanted for drug running. He's working for Hoffman Aviation, where the owner of the flight school is stopped with the largest heroin seizure in the state of Florida's history. I mean, the largest heroin seizure by the DEA in the state's history is on a plane owned by Muhammad Atta's boss. Now, that seizure happened 2 weeks after Muhammad Atta showed up. Now, where does heroin come from? Afghanistan. Okay, so what do we have a problem here. Muhammad Atta's boss never got arrested, and he got to keep his plane. Everyone else on that plane got arrested and charged. Who does this guy know that he walks away, never gets charged, and gets to keep his plane? You ever heard of that? That doesn't happen.
That's unbelievable.
So, you know,
this is the problem, Jonathan, though, like, but to like minds, this makes this, like, some of this information you've got is really awesome, and like there needs to be a condensation on just Muhammad Atta, maybe all over YouTube.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, I just can't help but think, just because I've been trying to sort of say stuff about 9/11 since 2005, that as soon as you get into anything deep too in a rational, serious, documented way, people switch off. A lot of people switch off. Like you said, a lot of people haven't got investigative sort of minds, and they get real cynical and go, "Oh wow, Sherlock Holmes, huh?" You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, or they just can't. Or they say it's circumstantial. A lot of that might seem circumstantial. You know, he's involved in drug running. They get involved in drug running. It's opium, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They might think that you're just making connections where connections don't exist. But this mm-hmm. is it's behind such logic that the societies can hide themselves, right?
Right. Well, one of the things that people have to study, the art of propaganda and conversation tactics, especially conversation control tactics, is something that people have to pick up. Now, some people see this as an immoral debate, so they don't get into that kind of stuff. I do. When I refuse to talk to people unless there's certain criteria are met, that there's an understanding that they don't know anything about 9/11. I'm not going to continue a conversation with somebody, you know, who addresses me about my work unless I say, you want to talk about my work? Okay, did you read the 9/11 Commission report? Just I should say, oh, you didn't. Okay, well, then we have a problem because you don't even know what the story is, do you? And so I will spend 5 to 10 minutes explaining to the person, you don't know anything. You don't know what you're talking about, and you're playing with fire. I would highly suggest that you do not engage in a conversation with me till you know exactly what it is you're going to say, because you're going to hurt yourself. You're going to hurt yourself, and you're going to make yourself look bad. Now, I get like that. I get a little bit more intimidating. You know how they look at me like, my God, you're right. I don't know what I'm talking about. Like, yeah, see, repeat it after me. I don't know. See, one another one. I don't know what I'm talking about. See, you they don't. No offense, but don't talk to me if you don't know what you're talking about, because I don't have time for you. I'm sorry.
You know what's real funny is the people who don't know what they're talking about, and they get real angry when they don't know what they're getting angry about.
Right, exactly. And let them get angry. They look like buffoons. So, yeah, I refuse to talk to people until I achieve, as they say in the propaganda tactics, a certain personality, respect with the person. They have to put me in a position as their teacher. And you have to gain the dominant control of the conversation. If you don't have control, the person will belittle you and they'll use the tactics against you. So you have to familiarize yourself with those tactics. But
that's why we lose 90% of people.
Well, they get nice. They're trying to be polite to these people. You don't want to be polite to somebody who's a jerk. He has no respect for you. Demand your respect first, and then you can talk. Because once it's an even battlefield, then it's great. But I don't even demand an even battlefield. I demand that they admit they don't know what they're talking about, that they're on my field, they're on my turf. Mm. You know?
Yeah, and that happens a lot, right? And you explain things to, say, family members or even random people on the street. And, you know, unless they have that respect for you, it's like you said, you know, they just kind of break down and there's no effectiveness, really,
right,
with any conversation with these people. It's like a waste of effort unless, of course, you're just trying to prove a point. And I'll often try and prove points with the Israeli issue, for example, you know, when you say, oh, well, it's not very nice to be committing copious quantities of genocide. And anybody who really supports genocide is really psycho. And then you get these comments like, F you, we're the Zionist state, we will gut you and we will kill all your children and all that. And I said, thank you. You just proved my point.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I spent a few months out in Israel back in 2001, so I experienced it firsthand. So I'm very well versed when talking about that topic. Usually when somebody talks to me about it, I go, well, first of all, have you been there? And they go, no, you nine times out of ten, they go, no. I go, oh, okay, well, why don't you go there so you know what you're talking about? So I was there. I was actually in a military training program, so I think I had access to information that most people don't. So I saw it firsthand. So like I said, I always demand the respect first. I get their respect first so that they look up to me and that they want to learn. And that you have to achieve that within the first 5 to 10 minutes, otherwise you're wasting your time. But I always get that. And even if they don't listen to that, I show them links. I go, look, there's Orthodox Jews, there's Rabbi David Weiss, there's secular Jews like Norman Finkelstein, there's Holocaust survivors like Hedy Epstein. I can go all day and night with you. There's 3,000 Jews that signed a petition. Even scientists, famous scientists like Albert Einstein, hear what he has to say about the issue about Zionism. I will show people links, and they will see.
Over and over again. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back with our guest, Jonathan Alanoff.
Look at me, driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure. My cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations. I'll let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations. Have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command. Cause I can guide a missile by satellite.
I am well. And we are talking to Jonathan Alanoff, great researcher. We're having a really interesting conversation here, Jonathan, aren't we, about everything from 9/11 to Israel and just how complex issues are and the oversimplifications and misinterpretations that are all too prevalent in society.
Mm-hmm.
So you were talking to previous to the break about the different sort of, if we're going to be crude about it, different types of Jews. And, but no one knows this, you know. No one knows the difference between Ashkenazi, Talmudic, you know, all the different...
Sephardi, right. You know?
And no one, no one knows about the attempted second Holocaust of Sephardic Jews in 1951. And the U.S. government paying six times the annual health budget and giving a certain number of X-ray machines to the Israeli government that year to have a ringworm treatment program, which resulted in the death of 6,000 youth at the time or soon after.
Right.
Unbelievable.
So, I mean, but a lot of people don't know about
who are the anti-Semites. I mean, the anti-Semites are the Ashkenazis in the U.S. government, to be honest.
That's still a big stereotype. I mean, well, Rabbi David Weiss is an Ashkenazi Jew. Norman Finkelstein is an Ashkenazi Jew. Eddie Epstein's an Ashkenazi Jew. I come from an Ashkenazi Jewish background as well as Sephardi Jew. My grandparents, my father's mother was Sephardi, and my father's father was Ashkenazi. My mother's not Jewish. She was a born Christian. She converted. Not so much. I don't think it's a racial thing. I think it's more belief based.
No, of course not. No. But when people talk about the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and they're all Jews and stuff, I mean, break that down for us. I mean, really?
Well,
a Jew to me
is a practicing Jew. To me, Judaism is a religion, not a race. So when people say, "Well, Rockefeller's a Jew," it's like, okay, then you're perpetrating the same Zionist stuff, the same Nazi theories of Jewish racial identity by saying that, you know, well, these guys have a Jewish name, they must be, there's some kind of racial Jew. It's like, no, you're perpetrating that whole Zionist thing by continuing that theory. People do that with me. They go, well, you're Jewish. I go, well, wait a second, why am I Jewish? Well, don't you come from Jews? So you're saying Judaism is a race? So you're perpetrating Zionism by just, you don't realize it. People don't realize it. But they think by calling me Jewish, they think, oh, well, see, you're racially Jew. Well, wait a second. Whoa. What are you, a Zionist? What, is Judaism a racial identity? No, it's belief. That's my theory. But I also think there's different practices. Now, I've met a lot of Orthodox Jews. I've met Haredi Jews who broke away from the Hasidic community, who are very, 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 even violently anti-Zionist, which is the Jews against Zionism and their group that they do. They burn Israeli flags. And these people are largely Ashkenazi Jews. The other thing is when you look at Rockefeller and Rothschild, these guys took on Jewish names. They were largely converts. But for the other part, they're not known practicing Jews. If you read the biographies, if you read their autobiographies, if you follow the books or the people who talk about them, they say these guys don't practice Judaism. They practice other more occultic stuff or pagan stuff or Satanism.
Freemasonry Satanism and stuff, whatever. Luciferianism.
They're not having bar mitzvahs and you know, they're not celebrating Yom Kippur. They're not actually practicing what most Jews practice. So
I find it really asinine when people try and make all these, you know, the Jews run the world, Zionists run the world sort of stuff.
I definitely agree that there's a pro-Zionist establishment. Don't get yourself on that. I mean, the Western establishment is Zionist. The Judeo-Christian world is predominantly biased towards, has a bias towards supporting Zionism, whether they like it or not. They don't realize it.
People argue that George Bush is Christian. This is one common thing that really frustrates me. Mm-hmm. And people say, well, George Bush is a Christian. I mean, how can you deny that? He goes to church. He's a Baptist. Or, you know, he's born again. And I said, well, yeah, he's also a member of Skull and Bones. And is it more or less difficult to walk into a church? Any church will let anyone in, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Or to masturbate in the coffin at Skull and Bones and go through their initiation ceremonies and everything else and be one of the 15 tapped in 1968. So George Bush to me is an occultist, the same as Tony Blair is, the same as 80-90%, probably 100% of these hardcore elites.
Mm-hmm.
I think the race thing's a real misnomer because we've got Saudi elites, Indian, Asian elites, New Zealand, Australian elites that are all in these same circles.
Well, the propaganda is also so powerful that it also affects, it's like a trickle-down effect. So, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict specifically, and I'm a big Palestine first, Palestinian rights first, and I can I don't want to really delve into that too much, but that's a big part of my identity. So for me, seeing it out there. I met a lot of Jews who don't agree with what's going on, who are very upset about it. You know, look at Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by his own government, by a fanatical fundamentalist wing within his own government of Jews who saw him as a traitor to Jews, to Zionism, to the nation, to everything. I mean, that was an inside job, his assassination in the 90s. So you have to remember, there's a large group, a large movement of Jews trying to do things, but they're usually killed, they're stopped, they're scared, or they give up, they become apathetic, and they just move to America, and they want nothing to do with it. They want, actually, that's a huge reason why a lot of Jews
like
don't go there anymore.
People, isn't it? The majority of people are good. The majority of ordinary people on the ground are good, and then some people in leadership are even good, but then you've got this undercurrent of scumbags, really, and no one can connect them, and they just go unseen. That it's a hidden hand, and the rest of society, like, it's like people hating on all Americans because of American foreign policy. It's the same thing. People hating all Israelites, you know.
People are trying to make it a racial issue to divide us all, but it's not a racial issue. It's a freedom issue.
Right,
because freedom is universal. It doesn't matter what color of your skin is. You still bleed when you're shot with a rifle. Pretty straightforward, I would have thought. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Our very special guest is Jonathan Alanoff, the core of corruption guy. And we'll be right back after the break. Dangerous scumbag, Zionist filth, and all the fanciful, fabulous corruption. Our special guest, the maker of Core of Corruption, Jonathan Alanoff, is on the line here. And after this quick 5-minute segment, we'll also be joined by Tim Selwyn from Tu Meke in New Zealand for a little panel discussion, if you're okay with that, John.
Yeah, that's awesome.
All right, cool, because it's a rare occasion where we can get a decent amount of really intelligent truthers together for a real in-depth discussion, and I'm sure that the listeners really appreciate this kind of thing because, well, let's face it, we have to put ourselves as the position of the teachers. See what I'm saying? Because there's a lot to learn about the New World Order, and I find it's interesting. When you start learning about the New World Order, you start learning an awful lot about yourself.
Yes, it is introspective, yeah. It is a spiritual wake-up, too. I agree.
Yeah, it's a multifaceted wake-up, you know, in many, many different ways, because it challenges your entire perception of reality itself. And then, of course, once you realize that 9/11's an inside job, it then becomes a choice between, are you going to do anything about it, or are you just going to continue being a slave and accept it? And those who continue to be slaves, I can't understand the mentality, namely because I'm not insane. And that's what it is, pure and simple. If you think that 9/11 wasn't an inside job, even after looking over the evidence, and you do nothing about it, it's madness.
Right.
Frankly. And, you know, in the truth movement, we find it, well, that's one of our challenges, isn't it? Is having so much contact with all this madness and dealing with it.
Right. Right. I was going to mention one more thing. The, you know, Mike Rivero recently left the GCN radio network for, at least he stated on a show that I saw, disagreements with Alex Jones about the state of Israel. And I wanted to mention that, you know, I personally like Alex Jones's films a lot. I always link to him his work on my website, and I'm a big supporter of his network. And I always have been. I have a lot of respect for the guy. I think a lot of his work is incredible, and I think his website's just top notch. But that said, I also want to say that I agree with, you know, there are people out there that scare the living daylights out of truthers and out of other people who are just waking up into looking at Israel because they're so radicalized. And I kind of agree with Alex on this, but on the other side, I also agree with Mike. And on the Alex side, he's right. There are violent groups that are anti-Jewish, that are just assholes. They scare everyone, and it's scary. And I don't know what to tell you about that, but it's scary. Those people scare me too. But that doesn't mean that speaking against Israel makes you anti-Israel. So.
No, it doesn't. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back with our special guest, Jonathan Alanoff and Tim Salen from Tumeke. Back in a moment.
Anger to a place that ain't gonna get up in your face. The facts we all get, but the system fails. We got to change the way we see the problem if we're gonna fix this place. My living soul don't care about the color of your face. Unite and roll, respect our right to live here on the land. It's Dino, I'm not Tita Tonga. We don't own the banks. The parliament does so where do you ever stand? They paying their bills off your back with hefty tax demands. Misleading our youth with alcohol, TV contrabands. So kids act up and disturb our community. Uninformed public then consents to a planned absurdity. What? Replace our human rights with commercial slavery. They print 100.
Welcome back.
They charge interest on the loan, but
ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about COINTELPRO and being CIA sponsored and whatnot, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. Slapping in the face of the CIA-sponsored coups that are being led against our nations as we speak. Now, we've got two special guests for a panel discussion here. First of its kind on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and it's quite impromptu, just like everything else. There's no effing rules on this show. No taboo topics, thank goodness. And I'd like to thank the owner of the network for that in particular. So, without further ado, we're introducing a new person to this panel discussion here is Tim Selwyn from Tumeke at tumeke.blogspot.com in New Zealand. That's T-U-M-E-K-E. Tumeke, it means too much. Tim, welcome back.
Hi, Vinny, and hello to Will as well.
All right, and not to mention, we have Jonathan Alanoff here online with us too. Jonathan, you there?
I'm here.
All right, fabulous. So we're all here. Now, I wanted to talk about what's happening in New Zealand at the moment. We're having this kind of voting block, right, with this so-called super city. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Jonathan, but basically the government has said to local government in New Zealand that, hey, all of those people that you've elected to represent you, we're going to throw them out and we're going to appoint our own people with no elections whatsoever. And then also on top of that, they say, hey, we're going to give you a puppet mayor to vote for as well, and you better be happy about it. And that's kind of something that goes across borders, doesn't it? Because we're all in the same boat here in terms of the corrupt scum that run our societies. So I kind of wanted to get into this subject here is like, we've got scumbags that run our society, right? And as truthers, what are we doing about it?
Well, should I take that one, Vinny?
Go for your life, Mark.
Yeah, well, the difficulty is, I mean, you mentioned the electoral system being changed. It's basically a forced amalgamation of all the local authorities in the Auckland region, 1.4 million people, the largest metropolitan area in New Zealand, all together. And we've also had a sort of a parallel restructuring, if you want to call it that, go down in Christchurch, which is the second biggest city down in the South Island. And they have had their regional council totally overturned and a dictatorship, basically, of commissioners appointed in the form of, or should I say, under the guise of reallocating and progressing water consents. So it's basically a privatisation of the Canterbury water table. And because the old regional council, who were elected, didn't want to do it, and it was very difficult, obviously, to allocate a scarce resource amongst, you know, competing people. It's a difficult task, and it wasn't going fast enough for the greedy farmers who want to irrigate as much as they can and use all that water for themselves and take it out of the natural ecosystem. And so they had the right-wing government went ahead and just abolished, basically overnight, these elected councillors and replaced them with their own appointed team. And then we had a terrible earthquake down there just, about a month ago or so, and in which case they suspended all the laws of New Zealand, basically, except for six laws, and said that they appointed another board of commissioners there to do whatever you want under the guise of these three controlling ministers. And this executive-style authority is very easy to do in New Zealand, because I don't know exactly what the situation is in America, but I'm pretty sure, and I think it's in Minnesota or whatever, is the only state that doesn't have a two-chamber system. Well, New Zealand only has one parliamentary chamber, and unfortunately every single one of them, 121 of them, voted in favour of this extremist law to abolish... to basically assert almost a king's right, if you will, of executive authority there to suspend any law they want under the guise of a national emergency. And I don't know exactly if Mr. Ellenhoff wants to draw parallels here, but I'm thinking of Germany, 1933, and the Reichstag fire, which was used as a so-called force majeure situation, which a totalitarian state used the powers to take over by threatening and deceiving the people. And I'm seeing parallels here in our small country doing the same thing. I'm not quite sure about where the US stands, because I get the feeling there that at least with such a permeation of elected officials, that there is some, you know, they have a deeper sense of democracy, I think, Vinny.
Take on this, Jonathan?
It sounds a lot like what's going on here in the United States, in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, really, is there? So, therefore, if our nations have the same problem, solving them can probably be done with similar methods, yes?
I'm gonna say so. You know, I've never been to Australia, but everything I read about that region is online, so I know basically when it comes to politics in that region, I know basically nothing.
Oh, well, it's because we're all under the same kind of court system, right? Is that we've now got a Supreme Court, and basically, every single English-speaking country is run under the same New World Order guise, you know, like our prime ministers and presidents are exactly the same, just puppets of the international bankers, and I don't think that anybody needs to know an awful lot about specific details within countries, because the general rules are all exactly the same. Whoever
well, that's
you
right,
vote
Vinny.
For... whoever you vote for is a puppet of banksters, and whoever gets into power will basically rape the country, rape the people, and do the precise opposite of what their political job description is. You know, like a justice minister is supposed to make sure that nobody gets any justice. A president is supposed to make sure that nobody gets any leadership.
Yeah, well, interestingly, Vinny, the attorneys general of New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the United States and the United Kingdom, i.e. the white countries, get together on a regular basis now to have meetings.
Secret meetings?
Well, they're advertised because it's on the government website there, but they have very vague things that the agenda is. It's basically about our Attorney General here, Jonathan, different somewhat from your Attorney General, Federal Attorney General, in that they don't really have any control here. They are more of a legal officer than an enforcement officer over here, but a lot of the subjects that come up at these meetings, and this is what I've gleaned from very cursory sort of briefs that they will release to us, and that is that it goes over into enforcement areas, and they're very hot on terrorism, of course. But our Attorney General doesn't really do this, but he attends the meetings. So I'm thinking maybe he only got the invite because he's from a white country. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, there's only a few Anglosphere countries here, and you're talking, well, you know, why isn't another country involved here? Why is it just these five countries? You know, what makes them special apart from the racial thing? And I'm thinking, well, maybe it is the legal system. But it's the issue of coordination is what I don't like. We've seen a lot of penalties here in New Zealand being ramped up via the UN and via various international agreements, you know, to increase the sentences and so forth, or create new crimes based on the hysteria generated in other countries. I suppose Vinny would say that the drug laws, to a large extent, are like that. And in the 30s, 40s and 50s, that's through the Attorneys General and so forth, that's how these laws got to be established all over the world. All I'm seeing now from the list, and I think I've seen two meetings now that they've actually put on, I mean, that they've said that they've had, and they're all terrorist-related. You know, we're talking about controlling or passports. We're talking about controlling movements of people. We're talking about surveillance. You know, these are all these hot issues that are coming up. And it is being coordinated at a very high level. You can't doubt that. But I haven't seen I'm guessing that the meetings at the minutes aren't going to be available. All we get to see is a very brief press statement that they will be attending a meeting. Jonathan, I don't know if this is up your alley or whatever.
No, but I'm learning a lot. I mean, I'm just kind of just listening. I'm enjoying what you have to say.
Now, this is the cool thing about you, John, is that traditionally when people become sort of teachers like you have, you know, and you command the respect, the other element is, of course, sitting down and listening to things that you don't already know about is quite a refreshing activity, isn't it? And this is kind of why I like Tim and why I bring him on every week, because regardless of the fact that I know what he's talking about, I always learn something new from him.
But I want to hear what Jonathan has to say, though. I'd love to hear what Jonathan has to say. What's his angle here? Yeah. You know, on the coordination issue, mainly of, you know, how international are these things, and how, you know, how, I suppose your main emphasis would obviously be the United States, and I guess you know that inside and out. But how is that plugging into what's happening with the rest of the world? Obviously, America's like this a centrifugal force, basically. Everything joins into it and comes off it eventually, because the US leads the way in so many fields. And politically, they manage to get their way, you know, over Europe and over the UN all the time. You know, I mean, their agenda carries a lot of weight and can, as I was saying, permeate through to all of these secondary countries.
Right.
So what's the situation there? How internationally plugged in are these people that are making the decisions?
Oh, I mean, I think more so here, but, you know, it's different everywhere you go. At least in the United States, I can say that, you know, it started here long before it started elsewhere. I'd like to think that, as a history major, that I understand what I read in its context, but I believe most of the modern day imperialism, in the sense of internationalism, globalism, where corporations and think tanks run everything, banks, that largely began its largest, most impactful war post World War II. And in that sense, the United States was hit long before that. So, here is really not much we can do to stop it here in the States. At least I'm optimistic. I want to believe we can. But, the way I look at it here is everyone in the United States that is waking up to this stuff is waking up when it's kind of too late. It's kind of like, if we had set sail around the world and we finally realized we're about to hit shore after we already circumferenced the Earth. It's like, oh, well, we're 10 miles out from the shore. Right? We're almost there, guys. And so I was like, yeah, can we turn around now? It's like, well, yeah, it's a long trip back. There's a lot of stuff that's happened. I'd like to think that there's a lot we can do, but I've become more of a believer that really, and it's not about electing representatives anymore or trying to change the system. I really believe it's about ending it and getting these guys out. And to be honest with you, committing crimes of treason is punishable by death. So if you want to get as radical as I believe these guys have no options. I don't think we have time to go to trials and things like that because they control the courts. I really just want to call them out as traitors, tell them what they're doing, and start a whole new government, start it all over again, start it based on the principles it was started on back then. I don't want to play their game. I don't want to enter their system. But that's my approach. I'm different than most.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, the state of Georgia is now looking at allowing people to drive without any licensing.
Interesting. Yeah.
Restoring the old constitutional travel laws, I think it was, where you can't restrict anybody else's travel through the use of licensing, which was very, very interesting, I thought. So on the one hand, right?
Well, that's a good thing. It's a positive thing.
It's interesting you should say that, Tim, say it's one of the few positive things. I think that positive things happen all the time. However, it's the negative things that are emphasized because the negative reporting that we have coming out through mainstream media, those are the imperative reports, the things that need to be pounced on by the truth movement, the things that need to be attacked, discredited, and given the plug play that they need to so that they don't go through. But in so doing, we're focusing our energy on what we don't want rather than putting our energy into what we do want. So in essence, it's also a distraction, and the good things kind of go into the sidelines to a certain extent. Don't they?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good insofar as long as the road toll in Georgia doesn't like triple or something. I mean, that would be a terrible result. But I don't think it would. But it's interesting here. We've just had some. Well, this is for Jonathan. He wouldn't know. But we've just had a reversal of a rule we've had, and this plugs into the international thing as well. In 1977, I think it was, because we drive on the left-hand side of the road, there's this weird rule we have about giving way to, is it everyone coming from your right or to your right or whatever? It's a weird rule. Now, the state of Victoria in Australia adopted it, I think, the same time we did. But everyone else in the whole world apparently has gone back on that. And so we're the only one in the world with this weird give way rule that they want to change. And they've just announced that after whatever it is, 30-odd years of having this rule, that we're now going to have to change it back to what it used to be in the 70s and what the rest of the world does as far as the give-way rules go. But what they've done as well is in this announcement, they've gone and said, I don't know, Vinny, if you've heard of this, but they're now going to have a license to drive what we call a moped, which is a vehicle, a two-wheeled vehicle, a motorized scooter, basically, that's under 50 cc's. And that's going to come in as well. So they're going to force people. At the moment, you can just have a learner's license, a learner's car license, and basically that means you know the rules of the road and that you can drive anything under 50 cc's, which we call a moped. They're now going to introduce a license for a moped. It's basically like introducing a license to ride a bicycle. And what I can't help but think it's another excuse the government's had of gouging, not just controlling us, but of using it as a revenue gathering exercise to help employ people in the government sector. I mean, I don't see the reason for it. You know, I don't think there's been any, you know, there's been no, in my experience, is it's actually a positive thing to encourage people to use energy efficient vehicles to get around in an urban environment. It seems logical that you'd try to keep the barriers as open as possible. I mean, maybe not as open as Georgia and have no license, but I mean, why are they doing this? Why are they, and they're sneaking it in too. Most people don't know about this rule.
Yeah, well, you can't get people to drink a bottle of poison unless it's if it's got a skull and crossbones on it. You have to deceive them and tell them that it's really sweet and good for your health, just like restrictions on everything and track and trace you wherever you go. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back. Eastwood Show crew, we hope you like jamming too. Welcome back. We are discussing the New World Order, and as activists, as truthers, what are our responsibilities? You know, I don't know. Perhaps I can go back to a base premise, which is, you know, sort of a loyalty aspect, loyalty to, say, freedom. Or loyalty to, say, one's people. Now, the difficulty with loyalty, I find, in this society is that it's so corrupt, and corrupt in so many multifaceted ways, that often we can be confused and wind up supporting things that we ought to not support and simply not understand it. This is the problem that the public really has, to my mind, that needs to change. And I think that resisting the New World Order is probably one of the most fun things that I've ever done, because I feel alive when I do it. When I do not resist, it's almost as if I've been resigned to death. You know, because it's like I'm giving up on life by failing to resist. What's your take on that, John?
So what's my take on the misdirection of the efforts? Or, I'm sorry, can you rephrase the question?
Well, I was just kind of talking about
being really deeply depressed about the situation. I think to sort of bring up your question, Vinny, it's almost as though the times when you should have spoken up and said something or done something to stop something you know is wrong is the times when I've felt the most regret. I think I've always regretted those moments when I could have said something at some point and I just didn't, and I just let it slide, and the whole system just continues on as awful as ever, and I feel as though I'm partly to blame for it, because I, you know, there was an opportunity there to do something, even if it was a small thing, and I didn't, and that really irks me when that happens. Is that what you're talking about, Vinny?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And, you know, personal responsibility, for example, is something that's actually quite a difficult weight and a burden to bear. And when we're dealing with subjects such as the New World Order, such as 9/11 being an inside job, personal responsibility gets to such high levels, I believe, that it actually puts incredible pressure and strain upon the non-corrupt of us. Those who actually have honor, those who have respect for human life, are often those who are the most challenged by it, and at the same time are those who are the most dangerous to the New World Order itself. And I think it's through explaining these things in such a way, like Core of Corruption does, that you can help other people to realize what their responsibilities they're shirking really, really are, and what being responsible for the survival of your species, okay? Because that's basically what we're riding on here. That's what the truth movement is really about, in my mind, is saving our species from this corruption.
Could I ask Jonathan a question at this point, if I could?
Please.
You've made this documentary series. What was the most, in your research, what was the most, I mean, obviously you've done a lot of background research and you'd know your field very well beforehand, but what was in your research, what was the most, to you, disturbing revelation that you hadn't realized before, or the depth of it before? Was there anything that stood out for you?
I've had a few of those, but I would say that one that comes to mind offhand is that 9/11 is just an echo of a much older, longer tale. And the most disturbing reality of 9/11 is that when you research it long enough and you read all the books and do it, you know, goes. I was in Florida interviewing, you know, people who trained Muhammad Atta. I mean, this project brought me all over the place, and it was really interesting. But it made me realize, learning about, you know, Oklahoma City bombing and the first World Trade Center bombing and the BCCI and then Iran-Contra and Watergate and Kennedy, going back and back and back, you start learning a lot of common names, groups, fronts, networks. The most disturbing reality is that 9/11 is not a single event that shapes the conspiracy. It's just another chapter of something much bigger. That was the most disturbing reality.
And so where's it going back to? Is there a genesis point in this? Is there a...
I believe absolutely there is. I mean, in speaking in terms of... historically, this kind of stuff happens throughout history. You can date this back to Babylon. But if we want to get into the current conquerors, if we want to be very specific in articulating this network, which is currently on top of the world, if you will, with their
the dominance.
Control,
yeah,
they are by far achieved most of their control in the last 75 years.
So from the depression onwards, was there an event in the depression that? Or the wool market, stock market.
I would say that the Federal Reserve Bank was institutional in doing this. You could say, arguably, that the central banking in Europe could be the origin of this. It's really just this is a major power shift, depending on what philosophy of history you take. Some people, if you go David Icke's route, it's a different philosophy than if you go Jordan Maxwell or some of these other guys. There's a lot of different people who write about this point in history. But when you're speaking in terms of the military domination, which includes black ops and counterterrorism and false flag terrorism and all that stuff, you know, spy programs, that relatively started around World War I, World War II. And at the end of the World War II era, the Western establishment had it. They did it. They took it. And then they debated over what method they were going to get the rest of the world to fall under their system. And that's my philosophy of history. And if you really study communism and its origin, which comes from Wall Street, if you read Hoover's Institute, The Origin of Communism, which is all funded on Wall Street, which is all funded by the Western powers, the bankers and the backers of both sides of the Cold War were the same people. So they literally played off two people like a football team and invaded every country in the name of defending that country from the other enemy, you know. So they'd either go into one country saying, we're here to protect you from the communists, or we're here to protect you from the capitalists. Give us your resources. Give us this. Let our military build a base. We'll train you this. And as they fought around the world in the Cold War, when they were ready to pull the plug on it, which they did in the 80s, all of the countries that were under the communist control went to the Western establishment. It was the first time that the Western world was able to conveniently snake its way into control into other countries in the name of protecting it from an enemy. It's their game.
Yeah, the bankers are the Don King of geopolitics.
Absolutely.
You know, they own both fighters, and whichever fighter they want to go down goes down, and Don King still wins. You know,
that's right.
People don't realize that we're engaged in false debates a lot of the times. And this is the thing. We've got disagreements between high-level truthers, you know, like Alex Jones, David Icke, Jordan Maxwell, and all of these wonderful people. I love all of their work. And yet there are people that that follow individually each of these people and then decide that, no, this guy is right. No, this guy is right. And I think that that's a false argument. I think that the argument really is, okay, knowing what we know and knowing what we know for a fact is fact, okay, which is the New World Order is trying to exterminate us, you know, that's period fact as far as I'm concerned. There's documented evidence to suggest that, and it's silly to think otherwise. Then let's go from there. What I don't like is people who start to bandy about the details, all right, because... And I'm not saying, you know, people shouldn't debate details and all that. That's fine. But when they turn it instead of an intellectual debate about what the details actually are, where the real evidence is and all of that, and it turns into instead character assassination, much like the climate cultist movement will demonize people and call them climate deniers. It's what's it called? The ad hominem argument. You know, and that just kind of feeds back into the whole system that enslaves us all. Is to start attacking each other and being our own worst enemies.
I think this happens, Vinny, though, for a very specific and real reason, and that is because of what Jonathan was talking about before. The feds don't just watch drugs being trafficked. They're in there. They have guys on the inside. And they also have guys on the inside of the 9/11 Truth Movement, believe it or not.
Absolutely.
And the anti-New World Order movement. And so Absolutely. It's not a matter of if, but who. And I'm not wanting to point the finger or anything, but, you know, I judge people by their works. That's why I judge people like the creator of Zeitgeist.
Right. Because
he's a strong
I couldn't agree more with you there. I actually come from the belief, the theory that I think these guys had infiltrators in 9/11 Truth even before 9/11. I think that people don't understand that they know exactly what they're doing. But I'm not going to go down my speculation. But I do believe, you know, there is a little too much. There's too much effort out there that people spend trying to say who's an agent or whatever. I've never gotten into that. I just stick to the information, present the facts, share what I think is the truth, try to be productive. You know, you just kind of have to move on and see past all that stuff, you know?
I agree. Yeah. I agree. Like, I support all the major guys and all who are pushing 9/11 Truth, even if they are agents. But no, to me, there are some really great, honest people involved in this, and I include David Icke and Alex Jones. And
Absolutely.
At the top of that list of really great people, but I will I know it's consequential maybe for me, but I will publicly say that the Zeitgeist Movement and Peter Joseph completely co-opted New World Order shills.
I look at Peter Joseph as kind of like a remix artist, you know, like a not a hip hop freestyler, but somebody who took old rhythms, beats, and then put it together. And I, you know, Zeitgeist was a great film. There's excellent stuff in there. But my only issue is, and I don't have any negative feelings towards Peter Joseph. I'm friends with a lot of the Zeitgeist people, and I work with all those guys. But a lot of those guys, and I've met a lot of them, woke up because of Zeitgeist. And I think that's incredible. That film did a great job waking people up. What a lot of the people in Zeitgeist don't realize that I've met is that none of in his film is original. All of that work was taken from other films and other people's research, and he basically mixed together his own cut-up of other people's work and then injected his own opinions and his own conclusions, which is fine. He's entitled to do that. There's nothing wrong with that in terms of, you know, that philosophy. However, there are people who say, well, he did all this work. He found this out. He must know the answers. Like, wait a second. He referenced this film in Zeitgeist, which disagrees with his conclusion right off the bat. Let's go to this chapter. He referenced this guy's work, who also disagrees with his conclusion. So let's make sure we understand something here. There are people who did a lot of the work that he referenced who have come to completely different conclusions as he did. And they did the work. They did the research that he referenced. And I'm not saying that they're right either. I'm saying that it's important to understand that his work is not original, that he is absolutely, without a doubt, taking other people's work and then giving his thesis, his hypothesis, and conclusion on someone else's work. And that's it's okay for him to do that, well, but you have to call it what it is.
That's not why I have a beef with him, really, because I believe in common grounds. And, you know, it's just like Alex Jones. He puts his stuff out there and says, spread it around, because he knows if people spread it around, take his stuff for free, it's going to come back to him in one form or another in a positive way.
Right.
You know, that's free market, smart people can work that out. Yeah. Big government socialist types can't. Peter Joseph is also, what I don't agree with him, he's also backed by these Theosophics and Lucis Trust type people, and he's pushing a new world order, but it's a positive one, and that can't, it's just pragmatically, that can't happen, because you can't even get 10 people, in 10 thinking people in a room agreeing.
Right. I have an admission.
6.7 billion people, you know.
I have an admission to make. Peter Joseph uses the exact same thing that I do. I haven't done the research. Okay. I stand on the shoulders of giants, people who have done the research and have summarized it for me, and then I have a look at all these different summaries and try to come up and try to formulate an opinion based on those. When contradictory evidence comes across, then I have to really kind of look at it and think, okay, accept it as a possibility instantly, and deny nothing. All right, because then I'd just become a conspiracy denier, wouldn't I? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, our special guest, Jonathan Alanoff of Core of Corruption, and Tim Selwyn from 2MEC. And we will be right back after the break.
Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. And we have just been having a really fabulous show, and I'd just like to thank the our fabulous board op. He's having a wee bit of illness problems at the moment, as we all are to certain extents. But we keep trucking on, don't we? And I'd like to thank our guests, Tim Selwyn from 2MEC Air, and Jonathan Alanoff from Core of Corruption. Guys, thank you very much for joining us.
No, you're welcome.
Thanks for having it.
It's been good.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been good to talk to Jonathan as well. It's been excellent.
Mm-hmm. Well, we still have a little bit of time left together, and I'd like to wrap up the show. Do you have any final words here, Jonathan?
I was going to say a lot of the discussion so far has been a lot about morals and moral authority and all that on this show, and I really appreciate that because it's not talked a lot about. And I wanted to mention that before you on the show. You know, my biggest critique of people jumping to conclusions, as I've noticed both in the info warrior angles and the We Are Change and Zeitgeist and all that, is that there's a lot of assumption that human beings are born good or human beings are born evil or whatever philosophy you take. I come from a different philosophy, and this is why I disagree with Zeitgeist and Peter Joseph. Is that I very, very extreme disagreement that people are born as creatures, as animals, and we have instinct, and we have to procreate, and we have to eat, and we have to survive. And procreation brings on philosophy of morals. Do you ask a woman before you have sex with her, or do you rape her? Where does this come in? So are morals taught, or do you have to procreate? What do you have when you feel an estrogen or a testosterone imbalance? And where I disagree with Zeitgeist's conclusions is it's very naive to assume that some major evolution of man has taken place, that all of us are postmodern intellectuals, and there is no instinct, there's not going to be envy, jealousy, people aren't going to have rage. You know, a lot of murders are committed out of just hatred, out of violence, out of anger, not out of money. And I disagree 100% with Peter Joseph
in the insinuation that money is the root of evil, because long before money, we were killing each other out of anger, jealousy, rage, envy, because I want his house or his cave or his woman. So people should not kid themselves. So the philosophy of that is major.
You're dead right. They're just going to medicate the emotions out of us, just like Soma in Brave New World. I mean, really, like you're right. And the primitive instincts are also the driving factors behind humanity, and you can't have one without the other, in my opinion. And it's just a really dangerous line to go down.
It's our culture and our history is disagreements, and as Jonathan was saying, envy, lust, all of those traditional negative elements there. I mean, that's who we are.
As far as I'm concerned, the truth of movement is much like colonization. What we're trying to do is we're trying to find a land, okay, where we can have some common ground to stand on. That's what I really want. I want some blimmin' unity in the truth movement. I want us to really be able to listen to each other, especially when we're wrong, as Peter Joseph is.
The common ground is nature, Vinny, and I'm not a pantheist, but I say the common ground is nature, not in the same sense as the earth worshipping people would. But Peter Joseph is all nurture. He sees it as 90-10 nature nurture. See, I see it more 50-50 or 60-40 maybe in terms of nature.
What gets up my guff about that guy is he denies that the New World Order exists. He denies that there's an elite. He denies that, you know, and he says that anybody who doesn't deny it is quote, effing stupid.
Maybe he's covering up for his handlers.
I think the issue is the degree of coordination and cooperation between the elites and what that means. And, you know, I was talking to Jonathan about where it goes back to. I mean, you talk about meetings, Bilderberg, etc., Davros, you know, so a lot of these meetings are actually in the open, and so all the Attorneys General meeting, you know, it is in the open, but it's what is hidden, you know, what are those other meetings that are taking place and between whom and why? And because of the secrecy and the veil that's over it, of course it's open to, you know, an amazing array of contests between ideas about what it may mean and who's involved exactly. And that's the mystery of it, I suppose, and what people are trying to unravel is through the secrecy where things add up, the connections.
And when you tell people about the secrets of the world, it's a very few people that will listen to that being told to them and then ask a question to clarify. Those are the people that are really, really smart, the people who actually ask questions when you tell them something.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of dots on the page, but everyone's drawing a different picture using different dots, you know? And who's going to draw the most accurate picture of the dots, and are the dots changing, you know? I mean, there are so many factors involved. It's an amazing piece of research. Of course it's got to be 35 episodes or whatever, Jonathan, because it deserves it. It probably deserves 99 episodes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, my mother was an anthropologist, paleoanthropologist, at Stanford University. So I grew up hearing the nature-nurture argument and a huge part of evolutionary theory. Where Peter Joseph gets naive is that there is 100% scientific evidence that we have observed. It's not evidence. Science is observation. That's all it is, not facts. And we have observed multiple cases where there are people who have a genetic imbalance. They cannot help their genetic impulses, not only with diseases psychologically or physically, but with chemical imbalances with testosterone or even anger management problems that they have diagnosed as genetic. But on the same token, we have also observed many hundreds and thousands of cases where people have very little impact and they can control their genetic and impulse sense, and that they have an intellectual override. So both are there, both exist. It's naive to think that we are all one or the other.
All right, and thank you so much, Jonathan Elinoff from coreofcorruption.com and Tim Selwyn from tumeke.blogspot.com. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on the Vinny Eastwood Show. The Intel Hub, ladies and gentlemen, is coming up next, and we'll catch you tomorrow.